Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. So Lumpur has asked me if I would give a Dhamma talk tonight. It's May 3rd, 8th day of the waning moon, so it's the little Wanpra Noi. And we've been doing a lot of work cleaning up the monastery, anticipating the arrival of Thanachen Than tomorrow, along with Ajahn Teja Panyo, Ajahn Moshe, Ajahn Kimawaro, a group of lay people. Receiving visitors, kind of a good time to clean up the monastery. Doing a lot of line trimming, cleaning up. Ajahn Than is a very, very special monk. So one of the opportunities that we get here, living at Abhayagiri, is just to meet truly great beings. And so I was kind of thinking what to talk about, and I thought just bringing to mind the situation that we're in here and how incredibly good and wholesome it is on many different levels. One is, like with Ajahn Than coming, the opportunity to meet great beings, but also just the activities, the schedule of meditation, work, maintaining the monastery, cleaning things up in a way that when we see things that are clean, it can give rise to a mind that's just bright and internally clean, peaceful. And then just keeping precepts. Everyone who's come here tonight is just giving importance to keeping precepts, giving importance to Dhamma practice. Some people are reading suttas. Some people are practicing loving kindness. Some people are devoting themselves to asubha kamatan, the unattractive nature of the body, anapanasati. And so this is a Dhamma community where all these different practices are taking place. And also being in the tradition of Ajahn Chah, the forest tradition, we make our robes, we patch our robes, so we have a certain look about us, and we work, we build things, maintain our kutis, cabins. And I was thinking today, there's a lot of monasteries in Thailand, monasteries and retreat centers where the lay people will visit, and they've got a kind of bins of white clothing for people who are going to come and keep the 8 precepts. Or a lot of the time, people keeping 5 precepts will wear, say for the men, a white shirt and black slacks, or women, white shirt and a black blouse. Or if you're keeping 8 precepts, would wear all white. So on the Wanpra, like at Wat Nongkhorpong, going to the monastery, everybody's wearing white. So a lot of the times, monasteries and retreat centers in Thailand, they'll have bins of these clothes that they can give out to people. So when you come as a guest at Abhayagiri, we've got bins of work clothes. We don't have whites. We're not going to give you whites when you come here and stay as a guest. But and it's been that way for years. It's just never been a question. We've just got like bins of work clothes. So as a male guest coming here, you'll be shown that the work clothes are located in the men's shower room during the orientation. And as a woman during orientation, you'll be shown that the work clothes are kept in the women's bathhouse. So yeah, we get to get down and dirty in the practice. But yeah, that seems to be like a hallmark of the Ajahn Chah branch monasteries. I remember reading an Ajahn Chah talk where he's talking to a layperson and he's saying, you know, you're really impressed with me because I just gave a really good talk and you think, oh, I'd like to come live at Wakapong because Ajahn Chah just gave a really good talk and really, I felt really bright and peaceful. But so you liked my talk, but if you come live at Wakapong, you might not like me so much because I'm going to make you work. So that seems to be a hallmark of these monasteries. But it's not just working for the sake of work. I mean, it's learning to put forth effort and, yeah, cleaning things. How we do anything will bleed into everything else. So if we, Ajahn Mun even would teach like that, like putting our mind to something and not just going about automatically doing what we have to do and trying to come up with, like, we need a set of exactly how we clean this and that and exactly how we do this and that so we don't have to think about it. But that's not really the way we do it. Is we pay attention when we're sweeping the floor. Is it actually getting clean, or are we just going through the motions? And we're dusting something. Is it actually getting clean, or are we just going through the motions and not really paying attention to what we're doing? And so that inevitably is going to carry on into the meditation practice. And also here, the work period is not really that long. It's a good part of the morning, then we have the meal. Then we have our open period in the afternoon, study and practice, and maybe take a rest as well. So there's a good balance here. It may eventually get to the point, or it might be the case sometimes, where there's the odd all-night work period, like at Wakapong, where some of the monks work all day and all night. On a regular basis, but we don't do that here yet. Some of us do. It's not mandatory. So I was reading this book during the winter retreat that Beth gave me, this Zen Works of Stonehouse. It's the Chinese Zen monk who lived in the east of China in the 1300s and lived as a hermit for most of his life, but was also abbot of a monastery for 8 years. And so this book is, he gave very short teachings whenever he taught, and a lot of the book is poems that he wrote or advice that he wrote out for people while he was in his mountain retreat. He spent over 20 years just living by himself on a mountain. So a lot of the book is poems, but also there's some of his short Dhamma reflections, kind of like the morning reflection here, actually very similar content to a lot of his short reflections, which were written down by one of his disciples. And a couple of things he said struck me that I gleaned from this book. One was, don't go around chasing delusions. I've never seen anyone who caught a delusion before. That was one. And then another teaching he gave was, let's see if I can remember. In your practice, try to get to the point where you don't find fault with anyone or anything in the whole world. That was another one that was striking to me. So this one about chasing delusions, It's like and nobody in the whole world has ever caught a delusion. So we're in general kind of following various desires. And anytime we follow that desire, it's leaving us bereft at the end. So even if it gets fulfilled, then that fulfillment isn't quite what the desire was telling us. So that's how I read into that. It's kind of the delusion coming and telling us, yeah, if you get this or that, your suffering might become less. Or if you attain this or that, then you'll be happy. So we follow after that. You know, it can be something as subtle as if you get that good food or this good food, or if you just finish that work project, if I just finish this line trimming, then there will be some sort of fulfillment that comes with that, and then I'll be happy. And so we can follow after that. Or if I get this or that praise, then it'll be okay. If I can avoid a criticism, I can avoid all criticism and shift everything around in my life so that nobody criticizes me, then it'll be okay. So that's kind of chasing after the delusion. And then if we actually, by some chance, happen to attain that desire, then we're kind of left a little bit empty, bereft, just having to move on to the next thing, the next desire, and it goes on and on. So you never really get that fulfillment that desire was saying it would get. And the next one had a bit more food for thought for me, was getting to the point in your practice where you don't find fault with anyone or anything in the whole world. And that's a really difficult one, because it's so easy to say we get criticized or we have some sort of pain, say like knee pain or something. There's something wrong and I need to fix it. Or get criticized for something. And that person doesn't know what they're talking about. They shouldn't criticize me. I'm right, and I know I'm right. I'm sure that I'm right, and that person still is unjustly criticizing me. So that's something that is wrong and needs to be fixed. But actually, say with criticism, it's completely normal. Everybody in the world is criticized, and if there was no criticism, then something would be abnormal. It would be not the norm. So basically the norm is, say, the eight worldly winds. There's praise and criticism, fame and disrepute, gain and loss, and pleasure and pain. And those things are things that occur, and then we say they're right or wrong. But we don't ever really have to make a problem out of them. And like happiness and suffering, those are two sides of the same coin. And all the worldly winds, they define each other, and they're bound to each other. So like happiness and suffering, or pleasure and pain, those are bound to each other. Or gain and loss, those are completely bound to each other. So when we practice, we're trying to take ourselves out of that, out of those worldly winds which buffet and move the mind all the time. Or like the Buddha under the Bodhi tree before his enlightenment, taking eight bundles of grass and sitting on them, and that's like a symbol. That's symbolic of the eight worldly winds, and the prince, not yet the Buddha, is sitting on those eight worldly winds, and he's just going to sit on them. He's not going to let his mind be moved by them. And so practicing Dhamma, it's like The mind, the habit of the mind, is to be moved by these things. And we can't just by an act of will or by thinking the right thoughts somehow make the mind not moved by, say, gain and loss, pleasure and pain. And so that's why the Buddha taught the path of practice. And this path, it's to be internalized, to be brought in. It's not something in the book or something on the outside. When Ajahn Bunkau was here in 2003, I was newly ordained, and something he said struck me. The Dhamma is just so interesting because it's the Dhamma isn't the text, it isn't what's in the book, but we are the living Dhamma. That's why it's so interesting. It is. Yeah, everything that's happening within us. And so it's not something outside. It's, you know, we have to see that this is, these are processes happening inside of us. So these, say, transcending the worldly winds. So like you have pleasure and pain, and gain and loss, and fame and disrepute, and praise and blame. And because these all define each other, then what we want to try to do is transcend them somehow. And it's interesting because these worldly winds, they're all bound up with thinking, mental formations, the Buddha called sankhara, and the whole conditioned realm in general. But what we're concerned with is the mind, the body and the mind, actually. And how these things are working together, and how these things are moved by these worldly winds, and how to transcend them by following the Noble Eightfold Path. And it is also something which is noble, because it requires a giving up, letting go. And we say letting go, but also that's a difficult one, because we can't just do nothing. So there's action that has to take place, right speech, right action. Things have to be right. The word is samma, so right or perfect, in perfect balance. So we say letting go, but what does that mean? We can't just do nothing, because that's not really letting go. We can't go about our lives in just an incredibly lackadaisical way and call that peace. But it's letting go with wisdom. Again, like the Krupa Ajahn's saying, knowing and letting go, know and let go. So you use mindfulness, you know what's happening, and then you let it go. Or even if you make a mistake, like the habit, especially for Westerners, not so much for Asians, but the habit, if we make a mistake, is to berate ourselves. And so that's not really knowing and letting go. We think if we berate ourselves enough or hammer ourselves every time we have a bad thought or make a mistake, that somehow we'll go into submission. Like Ajahn Amaro would say, or like one of my favorite Ajahn Amaro one-liners, it's like, the beatings will stop when morale improves. So really it's, you know, how do we deal with mistakes? It's, we have to know we made a mistake and let it go and move on and adjust our behavior accordingly. I also personally found it's really hard to adjust my behavior while I'm berating myself. So and it's also hard to be mindful. But if you know and let go, you remember things, there's mindfulness, the mind is clear, and you can move on. There's a way forward. And it's an adventure because it's a new experience. So knowing and letting go, everything's fresh. fresh and new in the moment. Whereas if we make a mistake and we're berating ourselves, that's something we've been doing our whole life, usually. So that's not really a new experience. And it's more of an adventure to try letting go and, try something else. See that that hasn't worked, so might as well try something else. And that word knowing as well, that brings up a whole bunch of suttas in my mind. Just like, say, the state of the mind of the Tathagata being vast and deep like the great ocean. And so, conversely, you could say the state of the unenlightened mind is shallow and not deep, not profound. It's just thinking, proliferating, and again, those eight worldly winds. So however great our pleasure and however much our pain is, those are still within the conditioned realm. And so we might be absorbed when we meditate and get into a state of wide-eyed, euphoric, heavenly bliss, or we might have incredible pain while we're meditating. But still, those are within the conditioned realm, pleasure and pain. No matter how much the pleasure is or how much the pain is, those are still just pleasure and pain. Now, if you have a state of incredible, euphoric, heavenly bliss, you're going to suffer when it leaves, when it goes away, when it changes. Or if you have pain, that's going to change. It's going to change too. It's going to come and go. That reminds me of another Ajahn Chah kind of quote was, "We don't practice to attain heaven. We practice for the sake of ending dukkha." And so those are two different things. If we're practicing for attaining heaven, that's still within the realm, still on the coin of happiness and suffering. But if we're practicing to put an end to all suffering, then that's transcending happiness and suffering. That's freedom. And the Buddha also said that all the teachings, they all have one taste, and that's the taste of complete freedom. So the conditioned realm has many tastes: happiness, bliss, suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, euphoria, etc. So those are the many tastes of the conditioned realm: neutral, bland, blank. And yet the unconditioned has one taste, the taste of freedom. So that, and it's freedom that's vast and deep like the great ocean. And if it could be cognized, or if it could be thought up, what it's like or what it is, then it wouldn't be vast and deep. It wouldn't be profound. But because it's by its nature beyond the conditioned realm, then it is vast and deep, and it is profound. And so we contemplate enlightenment or contemplate Nibbana in this way, bring it to mind, thinking, that's the goal of the practice, complete freedom. And we bring it to mind to keep ourselves moving forward, keep ourselves on track, keep a level of inspiration whereby we can keep going in the practice. It gives us impetus to keep going, keep renouncing, keep knowing, letting go. And it's difficult. Practice is difficult too, because we're going against the stream of those worldly winds. We're walking up the stream, we're walking into the wind. And we're doing it knowingly. There's going to be great benefit from doing this. thinking this way just behooves us to keep moving forward in the practice. Keep ourselves on track, in line with the Noble Eightfold Path. And we couldn't really be in a better situation to do it. So all of us here are extremely good people, and we're all incredibly fortunate to be able to be in this situation where we can study and practice Dhamma on a daily basis, and little by little move ourselves in the right direction. But it's also good to remember that the practice is going to go up and down. There's going to be peaks and valleys, and when we're moving through those valleys, to really be willing to move through them, move through difficulties, and just keep perspective around them. So using the Dhamma, using what we've studied, teachings of the Kripa Ajahn's, teachings of Ajahn Chah, really applying it, and that can really help us through the difficulties, no matter how difficult things get or how much a situation doesn't play according to what we expected or what we wanted. We can really use these teachings like not sure, or just impermanence, or not self, or like, oh yeah, all conditioned things are dukkha. Or if we get into a really good solid state of meditation, the mind is really bright, we still need to be applying the Dhamma, because that, without the application of Dhamma, these states of bliss and concentration, there is a danger there, and there are cases where people have gone completely insane from having a deep concentration experience because there was no application of Dhamma. Like in the suttas, the Buddha is saying that when you attain these states of concentration, if within or coming out of that, just after coming out of that state, you reflect, yeah, that was really great happiness, yet that is a conditioned state, and that's also conditioned, subject to change. Not self, not me, not who I am. And that right there is a gateway to the Dhamma. But if we get into a state of intense bliss or happiness and become really attached to it, and just want that over and over again, then that's still suffering. And yeah, that's cases where people have gone astray, particularly when there's no teacher around, I think, is the few cases I've heard about. People extremely diligent in practice. I heard about a case in Burma where this person is extremely diligent in their practice and attaining very deep states of concentration, and ended up going insane and just basically had to be committed to a mental institution. So it's quite sad if that happens, because that diligence isn't going to bear the best fruit that it could. So we're incredibly fortunate to be in this situation where we do have teachers, we do have teachings. We can keep our view straight and right, somewhat. And yeah, just the incredible, rare opportunity to meet beings like Tanajan Dan, who's be arriving probably later tomorrow evening. This is rambling a little bit, but I'll leave it there for this evening.
Sadhu.